Hello and welcome to True Crime Medieval 1000 Years of People Behaving Badly. I'm Anne Brannan, and I'm your host in Albuquerque.
And I'm Michelle Butler in Maryland, the most medieval and today quite soggy state in America. It's been raining since about 4 a.m.
Ooh, we had such a rain. We had such a storm last night that I actually thought it was hail, but it might have been raindrops being thrown against the window with great abandon, you know, by the storm. But then it snowed up on the mesa, but it didn't snow here. It's very cold. And so, yeah, we're having weather in Albuquerque and we're having weather in Maryland. And y'all are probably having weather too, but we don't know what it is because it's elsewhere. Today, we're celebrating April Fool's Day by discussing droit de seigneur, or jus primae noctis, which is supposedly the legal right of a lord to take the virginity of any bride on her wedding night instead of, you know, her husband doing it. Now, first of all, we want to be real clear on this. Do we think that people were raped in the Middle Ages? Yes, we do. Do we think that lords misbehaved themselves a lot in the Middle Ages? Yes, we do. Do we think that sometimes they raped peasant women? Yes, we do. We do not in any way think that these things didn't happen. However, what we don't think is that this was a legal right, or even really a custom, but we'll get to that later. Fair enough. Am I stating this correctly, Michelle?
I am altogether on board with that assessment.
Yeah, we don't want anybody to think that, you know, we don't think that women got raped in the Middle Ages, because that would be like, well, not just non-feminist, but entirely stupid. So we don't think that. But yeah, so this is an idea that a lot of people believe in, and it's a very popular idea. And Michelle will be explaining to us some ways in which it shows up in our popular literature and culture, even today.
And politics. I've got a couple examples of it being cited to justify political moves.
I'm just going to have to hit somebody with a hammer. All right. Just can't stand this. Anyway. All right. So our first question is, how did we get to the point where we even thought this thing existed? I'm now going to explain that because, as usual, my job is background and history and, of course, egging Michelle on. Anyway.
Okay.
In places, there was a fee that was paid for marriage by peasants to the lord of the land that they were bound to, and who paid it is a changeable thing, and what it was for is unclear. Might have been because the bride was leaving the lands that she was on, but basically it was probably just a tax on getting married, because the lords, in the feudal society, the lords of the land were very good at figuring out ways that you should give them money besides just being, you know, required to live on their lands and work the lands like forever in a goddamn day.
I mean, it's worth remembering that we pay for a marriage license even now. It's not like,
oh my God, that gives the judge the right to take the maidenhead of any kind of woman that's getting married. Yeah. Okay. Wait, no. Oops. There was a little jump in logic. Yeah, we do. We pay now. My son, by the way, is getting married soon, but they're having a Quaker wedding. Did you know that in some states in America, you can have a marriage where just simply by saying your vows to each other and having two witnesses, and that's legal, and it's legal in Pennsylvania, has been for hundreds of years. Why? Because it's a Quaker marriage. Yeah, so that's what he's having, but they still have to pay for the license, but they're not paying for an officiant.
That's lovely. I didn't know that was possible.
I didn't know it was possible. I didn't know it was a Quaker marriage. Drew and Maddie figured it out, and I told him it was a Quaker marriage, and so now he's all excited, because awesome, because history. So, you know, woohoo! Anyway, yeah. Yeah, but they still had to pay for a license. Later, it became interpreted as being a payment so that the Lord didn't, you know, exercise his droit de seigneur, but there's no evidence that that's ever what it was. Okay. What kinds of things might be evidence? There's a biography that was written in the early 10th century by Odo of Cluny, which reports a nobleman, you know, who's planning to rape one of his serfs, and then there's a miracle, so he doesn't, and he gets converted or whatnot. But that's not about a legal act, and it's not even about a custom. It's just about somebody intending to be evil. And there's a French poem from the 14th century where a lord claims the jus primae noctis. So there's clearly some kind of notion of it by the 14th century, but this is fiction. So, you know, and it's not showing up in the laws, and it's not showing up in the customs, but it's being talked about in fiction. So when did we first start talking about this as an actual thing? Hector Bochet, a Scottish historian, he's the first person to record the rite, and this was like in 1527, and he said that the rite had existed, apparently, throughout all damn time, until the late 11th century, when it got abolished, apparently, and he attributed the law to some invented king who never existed. So this whole theory is kind of suspicious, since it doesn't have anything to do with reality. And after that, he was the authority for lots of other legal scholars and historians, because there you are, somebody said it. The English in the 18th century, by the way, noted that this was a Scottish custom, and the English never did it. Just saying.
Yeah.
So that this was a legal rite in the Middle Ages, or at least a custom, was strongly believed by the 16th century, when, we remind everybody, historians and philosophers and theologians and popular culture started getting really invested in proving that the Middle Ages was a barbaric time, and that, thank God, we have all escaped from them into these much more cultured and sane and morally sound times that we live in today, blah, 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 blah. So at any rate, there's a context to this, which is Middle Ages bad. Thank God we got out.
You can't have the Renaissance if you don't have something you're leaving.
Yeah, if you're going to be a phoenix rising from the ashes, you got to burn something down, don't you just? All right, so hosts of these guys, historians, legal scholars, on through the 20th century, just passing this on as total reality, and it gets, you know, it's a great story too, isn't it? About the ghastliness of the Middle Ages. And you can really make very, very effective paintings, one of which at least will stick up on the website.
The paintings are awful. The 19th century loves this as a subject of art, and they're uniformly horrible.
Uniformly. It's kind of like I just put the death of William Rufus up on the site, and I had a big choice of, you know, interesting paintings of the romantic death of Billy Rufus. It's the same thing here. You can really punch the emotion up here. But there were voices saying, wait, no, where's the evidence? David Dalrymple in 1776 said that Boyce's version was entirely legendary. This is a true thing. But he was a Scotsman, so everybody said he was just saying that because he was trying to make the Scots not seem so barbaric in spite of the oatmeal and kilts. All right. So this goes on. More and worse versions, more and more bizarre lies. I want to add in here some other terrible, horrible lies that were told about was the feudal system good? No, it was not. Were lords well behaved? No, they weren't. But I tell you what, they was not legal, and they didn't do it was disembowel serfs so they could warm their feet and their intestines. So, like, just stop it. Anyway, so there's no evidence of the droit de seigneur as a right. There's no real evidence of it as a custom. And there's some evidence that it completely got made up, seeing as how the first person who wrote about it as a thing made stuff up that didn't exist whatsoever. So, do you have anything to add to all that before I go on to Ferdinand of Aragon?
There's another historian writing at roughly the same time as Boecha, who doesn't mention that king that he talks about at all. That other historian's name is John Major. He also wrote a history of Scotland in 1521, just, you know, a few years, like five, before Boecha. And he does not mention that king Evanus, the one that was supposed to have created this custom.
Yeah, the person who didn't exist.
A thousand years beforehand. And then King Malcolm, good King Malcolm in the 11th century was the one who outlawed it.
On account of Saint Margaret, his wife, made him do that. Yeah.
It's real, real likely that Boetia just makes up King Evanus because there's no other sources for this guy at all.
There's no, I've never heard of him. He doesn't show up in the genealogies, and there's a bunch of made up people in the genealogies, let me tell you, but it's not, you know, he's not there.
This is all the time a thing with this is people say, oh, I'm sure this existed in the past
over
there in that barbaric time, in that barbaric place.
Somebody else who isn't really as like us, not like us, no, somebody else did this thing which we will now tell stories about and also make some movies. Walter Scott's gonna get involved in here, and he just once again Walter Scott.
Yeah, he's on the list,
people I'd like to hit with a hammer. Walter Scott near the top. All right. So, any rate, so given the fact that there's no evidence for it, not really, why then did Ferdinand II of Aragon abolish it in 1486 if it didn't exist? Background. Gonna have background. Okay.
We need a theme song for the background time. It's time for background.
God, I love background. I'm in this for the background, don't you know? I'm totally, totally totes. The Sententia Arbitral of Guadalupe, which Ferdinand gave as a legal decree, this was, by the way, at the monastery of Santa Maria de Guadalupe in Extremadura in Spain, hence the name.
And this is that Ferdinand, right? Isabella and Ferdinand, Columbus's Ferdinand. That's what I thought.
Yes, it is. The same people who were all about the Inquisition and making the Recusant Jews be, you know, very, very unhappy and badly treated. Yes, he's not entirely great. And yet, here's a moment where he is tolerable to the people of true crime medieval. He's being tolerable at this moment. Okay, fair enough. He gave this as a legal decree, and it marked the end of the wars of the Remenses, which are a couple of peasant revolts, one that lasted from 1462 to 1472, and the next from 1484 to 1486. The Remensas were the Catalan serfs. And after the Black Death, the loss of workforce in Catalan had led to some of the worst conditions for servitude in Europe. Really bad. The Sententia Arbitral overturned the feudal system in Catalan to a degree, although it got translated into economic payments. But the Catalonian peasants ended up with more freedom than the peasants in the rest of Europe for, you know, a few centuries. It translated, when I say it translated into economic terms, I mean that they had to pay a fee per farm and they had to pay homage to the Lord. But the Sententia Arbitral specifically abolished a list of what was called evil customs, or called mals usos, and the evil customs included, I'm not even going to give you all the evil customs, just some of them. The Lord got a third of a peasant's inheritance if he didn't have any descendants. The Lord confiscated a third of the property of anybody who died without a will. Let's have a little moment where we think about what we think the percentage was of illiterate peasants who died without a will.
I would think pretty high.
Yeah. It's very high. The Lord confiscated a wife's dowry if she committed adultery. I'm like, okay, whatever. They added that in. You know what I mean? It's like the whole thing with wills. Oh, let me get some of your money. But like, I'm going to get your money if you commit adultery. Who cares? At any rate, the Lord got paid by the peasants for his goods if they got obliterated in an accidental fire. It's kind of like something like wicked evil form of insurance. And the peasants had to use the Lord's mills and ovens and forges, and they had to work the Lord's lands, yada yada. In Castile, there were some additions to this that were not actually written down, but were custom, including letting the Lord seize your cattle, and women who were breastfeeding had to give up their kids and go breastfeed the Lord's baby if his wife couldn't do it, stuff like that. But the jus primae noctis is not one of the evil customs. However, it's included in the sententia, so it's at least an issue at that point. You know, it's not. It's at least something that the peasants who were, you know, the peasants who were signing this agreement demanded as being taken off. And so, by the end of the 15th century in Catalan, a place where the lands, the lords of the area had gotten more out of hand than any other place in Europe, some of them had to have been practicing it and giving its supposedly ancient history as a foundation for the act. And so what this looks like is that the story gets invented and then taken through the centuries, the badnesses of the former times that aren't us. And by the time you get to the end of the Middle Ages, people are saying, well, yeah, it's all right. It's been all right forever. I used to do it in Scotland a long time ago, and now we're doing it. And so the story had become real, to at least to some extent, by that point.
Boy, we see that so much in the 15th century, where things are getting, stories are getting told about the earlier Middle Ages, that by the very, very end of the Middle Ages, people are like, huh, I wonder if that was true, and starting to act like it is true. You know, they're taking chivalry and knighthood are so different in the 15th century than they are like 300 years earlier, 200 years earlier, because they're taking their own stories seriously by that point. It's such an interesting cultural moment of, you know, we're not really medieval anymore, but we're not really early modern, and we're in this weird sort of transitional moment of reassessing the medieval, and having, we're so far away from some of this that it's hard for people to assess what's real about that past time. I'm fascinated by the 15th century.
Yeah, it's a very interesting time indeed. Yeah, and so here we have this, there's no evidence for this thing at all until we see it getting we see a law being passed against it, because all of a sudden it started being an issue when the feudal lords of Catalan began misbehaving themselves so badly that feudalism got taken away from them, basically. That's my conclusion, I think, about how that happened. Because I was like, why? Why is he abolishing this thing that didn't happen? So, the April Fools is not Ferdinand. The April Fools is really the lords of Catalan, who thought that this was a thing and then went and did it.
So just as a sidebar, we're living at a time right at the moment where there is no evidence of voter fraud, and yet there's like 40 fucking thousand laws being advanced trying to deal with it. So
I grant you that that is true.
So I can understand why a previous time period might look around and say, oh, there's this thing that we kind of feel like might be happening, so let's make a law against it.
So this wasn't on the law books, and we don't have evidence as custom. So you're saying it's possible that it actually wasn't happening at all, but the peasants were so used to being mistreated that they made the jump into taking this ancient story as being true. Because it didn't happen to me, but it happened to a friend of mine, or like,
yeah,
this friend
heard
of a friend
that
of mine.
They do this over there, and we want to make sure they don't do it here. I mean, I'm also willing to believe, though, that the lords got together and said, hey, have you heard this story? Do you do that? That would be sort of cool. I'd like to do that.
Either way, I would accept, but what's seems pretty clear to me has happened is that a made-up story has been in some way caused to become either true in reality or true in law. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, it is utterly, utterly fascinating that by 1482 there's enough of this rumor floating around that there's anxiety about whether it could be true. And so they, at that point, it goes into law in order to prevent it. I mean, that's where we see it in law, is when they're trying to prevent it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I would really like for that to be true, rather than that the lords of Catalan said, hey, yo, this is our ancient right. But yeah. I would buy either one, because the humans have shown capacity in both directions. But it wasn't there before. It just wasn't there.
One of the books that I read makes the point that if this existed, the French farces would have been all over it. Because the French farces aren't afraid to take on anything. And we don't have any.
No. No, there's no evidence. There's just no evidence for it until Ferdinand.
It becomes this giant signpost for later centuries as a way to define that's what that time period was like.
Yes, when really it's later times.
Yeah, it becomes one of the big stickers that gets slapped on the Middle Ages, and it's not true, but it has proven to be a very pervasive and enduring myth. That actually is mostly what I read about.
It's something that people want to believe, and that they, as a whole, not us, but that people would like to believe about the Middle Ages, and that they would like to believe that these times are different, the ones that we're living in.
Okay, another sidebar. If somebody can say on tape, what you do is you grab them by the pussy, and if you're famous enough, you can get away with it and still get elected president, I would say that we're not altogether having abandoned the idea that powerful people can misuse their power against women and get away with it.
That is true. That is true.
So, because so much of what we do with the past is we put things onto it that are true about ourselves, but we don't want to deal with. Mm. And so we put it back there and okay, that was one of the books that I read talked about this a lot, because in the 18th century is when all of the plays about this purported medieval law become hugely popular.
That's right. Voltaire is the first one who actually uses the term droit de seigneur.
Yes, yes. So you have all these plays, and this particular scholar, Barreau, is making the point that what had happened was that with the Protestant Reformation, all the brothels get closed as a matter of public morality. And so now you have these households, and the young men of the household do not have this ability to step outside the household and deal with their sexuality. And in particular, the young masters of the household are not being taken off to have their sexual initiation at the brothels. And instead, there's pressure put on the servants, the women servants in the household, to take up that role.
That is interesting. Because it isn't just that the sexual energy has to go someplace. It's that the idea that the sexual energy is entitled to go someplace is driving all of this. It's entitled to go someplace. Where does it go?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, in the Middle Ages, we did thus and such. The good old days. You know. Yeah.
Yes. Barreau is making the argument that these plays become popular at that time as a way of pushing it back and saying, well, at least we're not as bad as those guys. We have this thing we're doing, but it's not as bad as that.
No, there's a great deal of entitlement to women's bodies going on in the Middle Ages. This in particular is not one of the forms that it took in large part.
Yeah, I was reminded of Andreas Kapalanis's The Art of Love, where he has an entire section that is essentially a guide to figuring out whether that woman you just rode by is okay for you to rape. It's like a guide to rape, basically.
Right, right, right.
So
right,
yeah, right. We're not saying that there's this idealized past where men were built where everybody was well behaved and bad things never happened. But there's a really big difference between things that happen as opportune abuses of power and abuses of power that are written into the law.
Yes. And also abuse, and I would say even abuses of power that are
customarily accepted.
Yeah, okay, customarily accepted. I was looking for a verb for it, but yeah, that are customarily accepted. Yeah, it's interesting to me though, because it's like you can see how this would get invented. Because the power dynamic is there and is still here. The power dynamic is there. And you can see, so you can see how it would get invented, and you can also see how it would get misused. But it is that it is still such a focus for thinking about the Middle Ages is really, I think, what is amazing to me. But yeah, we do this a lot. Torture, for instance, the Middle Ages, they were full of torture. Not us, like, you know, except for Guantanamo, for instance, or places like, oh, we don't do that, except, you know. It's the Middle Ages.
All the bad things.
Mm. So what did you find, oh, my Michelle, in your looking for what we do with this silly idea?
So here's what I got for you. A really good scholarly starting point for anybody who wants to read about this would be to go to, surprisingly, a chapter in a book called The Medieval Chastity Belt.
Oh, no!
Randomly, I swear to you, this chapter exists because here's the conversation I imagine between the author and the editor. Okay, editor says, we'd love your book, but it's a monograph right now. And so I need you to add like 30 pages for it to be long enough for me to publish it as a book. And author says, okay, I think I can do that. And so we get this random chapter about the first night myth in the book about the chastity belt.
Now, this is a book about the chastity belt myth, isn't it?
Yes.
There weren't really any but we're going to do that maybe next April. We'll talk about chastity belts because they weren't there either.
So this is a book called The Medieval Chastity Belt, A Myth-Making Process. And, you know, that's primarily what he's talking about. He has another little sidebar into talking about the myth that everybody believed the earth was flat until 1492. But that's just literally a sidebar. It's not a whole chapter. So he has a chapter, though, about the first night thing, and it's a really nice launching point.
Good.
The book is fairly recent. It's from 2007, and it's a pretty clear and concise introduction to this. Okay. He has a nice quote here at the beginning of it. Although some historical documents suggest that something similar might have happened here or there, overall, the notion that a lord was entitled to sleep with the bride of a newlywed couple borders on the absurd. Nevertheless, its mythic status has had a deep impact on modern imagination about the medieval past. So, okay.
I'm totally down with this, yes.
So this is exciting, and it was even more exciting because he pointed me to a couple of great books and a slight little scholarly moment of tension, which was fun.
Oh, so, goody good.
I know. Tiny background, scholarly background. The author of this is a German scholar who worked at, let me make sure I'm getting the right university in Arizona here. He was, and possibly still is, a medievalist in the Department of German Studies at the University of Arizona. But he is from Germany, and that's important. He, in his chapter, points to an 1881 book by a fellow German. And this book is by Carl Schmitt. S-C-H-M-I-T-T, who Clausen says, put the nail in the coffin. This was the definitive study to prove that the right was never a thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he goes through, Schmitt goes through all of the supposed references that supposedly prove that it was a thing and systematically disproves them.
Yay!
Yes, so there's that. But there is a there, and then there's a book from 1998 called The Lord's First Night, The Myth of the Droit de, I think, Cuissage, C-U-I-S-S-A-G-E, by Alan Barreau. Okay, so this is a really good book too, but he's looking less at disproving that it was ever a thing and looking more at why it became a thing.
Yeah, which is also interesting, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. But Clausen is irritated on Schmidt's behalf that this really important book from 1881 exists and Barreau doesn't mention it until page 91.
Oh, the scholars.
Here we go. I want to quote it because I love it when you can detect these little moments of like, not all is well among the community.
Yes, I want to hear this.
Okay. Barreau, above all, refers to Carl Schmidt's monograph, praising its outstanding scholarship and objectivity, but his German was obviously lacking. Otherwise, he would have engaged with this highly erudite work from the start and would not have waited until page 91, where...
He should at least have brought it in page 25, obviously.
I have to agree, though, that, you know, he really kind of waits a long time and then sort of mentions, oh, yeah, there's this book from 1881 that totally already proves this thing I'm telling you I'm proving. Okay. Would not have waited until page 91, where he even comments on it with a certain condescension. Quote, myopic. He calls it myopic. When, in fact, Schmidt had already dealt a deadly blow to the myth of this ignobly fabled medieval custom, and Barreau could only contribute more specific French and Italian perspectives and data.
It's noble to be a scholar. It's really good.
I just love, though, the little like undercurrent of French and German that's going on with these guys.
Yeah, yeah. You didn't know German well enough, you know, obviously.
Oh, you didn't really read it, did you? Obscure
French things that were just hanging around, maybe Italian, whatever.
As far as I can tell, that book, Schmidt's 1881 book, which is so important, has never been published in English. I certainly was not able to locate. Maybe you, as the queen of the internet, could find it, but I could not find an English translation of it, which might explain one reason this is holding out for us, because we don't have the book that says, okay, let me go through it all real slowly and I'll explain it to you like you're in kindergarten. That's fake, that's fake, that's fake, that's fake.
Mm-hmm.
And this book, also Barreau's book, was published originally in French, and we have a translated edition of it here. This is a really great book. I found it really, really fascinating. He's the one who talks about the 18th century growing sexual contact between servants and households because of the closing of the brothels. He talks about the role of the belief in the first night myth and its role in the French Revolution, which I didn't know. It makes total sense that going
up to... You have to explain this.
That going up to the French Revolution, you have to make the aristocracy seem really, really bad.
Yes.
Yes. And that one of the ways you do this is you play up this idea that they were going around asserting their right to sleep with all the brides. Among other things, it actually talks about the Barber of Seville, which I figure you know better than I do.
I do know it some.
Is that hold on, let me find what he says about this in particular, because I'm sorry. It's The Marriage of Figaro. I'm sorry. I don't know opera at all. Okay.
Yeah. My parrot likes both of them, and so do I, and so yeah. What is it they say?
The Marriage of Figaro has the right as a big part of its plot.
Yeah. Poor Susanna.
Yes. And that apparently was helping.
Yeah, when is that from?
Let me look back and see. Find this part of the book again.
1786.
Here's Barrow talking about that. Quote, "The play's plot, The Marriage of Figaro, seems to espouse the cause of political and social unrest by showing the last throes of a landed aristocracy stubbornly demanding its privileges and its abusive rights."
Yeah, and the servants cleverly turning the tables and getting out of it. Yeah.
Barrow also makes the point that, generally speaking, as medievalists, we kind of were really uncomfortable talking about this because we don't actually, most of us haven't had it taught to us and we don't actually know whether it's a real thing or not. So mostly we just sort of sidestep it. And this is really interesting because I went to my bookshelf and pulled off, I have three books about, you know, medieval sexuality just kind of hanging out here because after all these time, like accumulating them. And okay, so James Brundage's, which is a great big book and is sort of the definitive book about where the law and sex interact. So it's called Law, sorry, let me just try this again. James Brundage's Law, Sex, and Christian Society in Medieval Europe, which is a definitive and giant book, does not mention it at all. Isn't that wild?
Since it wasn't there, that would make sense, but it's a myth that needs to get addressed in terms of talking about what
yes.
people think about sexuality in the Middle Ages.
Yep.
Interesting. Okay.
I have another book called Handbook of Medieval Sexuality, which was very, very useful in our previous episode about abortion.
Aha.
Also does not mention it. I have another book called Sexuality in Medieval Europe, Doing Unto Others, which is cleverly titled and funny, and only mentions it twice. And the mentions are to say this was not a thing. And that's all it says. It doesn't explain why it wasn't a thing. It just says there was no evidence for this and moves on. So that seems to me to kind of bear out what Barrow is saying, that we prefer to sidestep this discussion if we can. So there's another book from 1984 called Le Droit des Seigneurs in European and American Literature that actually deals with that piece of it, how it shows up in literature. It's referenced in George Orwell's 1984.
You know what? I did not remember that.
Yep. Isn't that fascinating? It's in the section right at the beginning. Well, actually, I think this is towards the beginning of 1984, where our main character is wondering about how he's supposed to tell what's real and what's not. And all he has is the history books. So there, Barrow gives a giant quote about this. And he's listing all the things that he's told in the history books might be real, that there were capitalists who owned everything, and there was a law that the capitalist had the right to sleep with any woman working in one of his factories. And it was called the jus prima noctis, and he has absolutely no idea whether it's, but okay, so here it is in George Orwell's 1984. It's referenced, I'm flabbergasted by what Barrow has pulled together here at the beginning of this book. In 1992, the French National Assembly was debating how to rewrite some of its legal code. And they weren't sure what to call sexual harassment because they don't like the term sexual harassment because that comes from English.
Uh-huh, yeah, I get that. I totally get that, yeah.
They decide to go with the French press is pushing for them to use what they see as the native equivalent of that Le Droit des Cuissages. Okay, 1992.
So, yeah, so it's being so this myth is being dragged out of the past because this is the language of our people for this thing which never existed.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was referenced by, it might be better if I just quote this. When Soviet troops invaded Afghanistan, the general secretary of the French Communist Party, Georges, Marché justified Soviet intervention, hold up, in the name of the Enlightenment, claiming that the, quote, feudal Afghans practice the droit de cuissage.
Oh my God. Well, you know, a lot of the discussion among scholars about Droit de Seigneur talked about anthropological roots, and so that was putting it back even further onto other places, other times, and so this is about taking a culture which is now and causing them to and attributing to them a thing which is seen as primitive.
Yeah. Brough talks about that in one of his chapters, the idea that some scholars think that if it existed, it's the remnants of a pagan fertility rite, but he's...
No, it isn't.
He's definitely not saying that's true. He's saying that some people have argued it.
Well, they were wrong. Also, as we noted last time, William Rufus was not part of a pagan sacrifice either. And so let's just mention that and move on.
So I have one ridiculous and fun thing to share with
you. Okay. What is it?
Because using it to justify the invasion of Afghanistan is pretty heavy. But
it's pretty bad.
Charlton Heston was in a movie in 1965 called The Warlord that uses the jus as a plot point, a major plot point, not like, oh, we just mentioned this thing over here. It's a major plot point. He is playing this lord. Hold on. I'll go over to it on IMDb. He is playing a lord in the 11th century who has a thing for this woman, Forsyth, and she refuses to leave her fiancé, and so the lord is delighted to discover he's got this option.
How did he find this? Is he like reading old law books or something? He's like, look at the library. What are my rights as a feudal lord? What do I get to do? Because, I already took all the money from the adulterous women.
The entire thing is in fact on YouTube, but I made it through the trailer and now I'm not going any farther.
No, okay. I'm sorry. I can't do it. I'm just going to have to take your word for it. Yeah.
Even more troubling is the review on IMDb from 2004. I cannot believe this. Somebody wrote in 2004, quote, a painstakingly accurate historical and it goes on from there.
You know, if in general, a good rule of thumb is that if Charlton Heston is in the cast list, historically accurate is not a thing you want to put on there, but that's just me.
I saw the love interest, so to speak, name is Bronwyn. It's played by Rosemary Forsythe. I'm sorry. I was willing Bronwyn. To buy that they named her Forsythe. I saw an interview with her fairly recently because she was a young woman in the movie and she was a much older woman in the interview. I saw an interview with her about this that I actually managed to watch the whole way through. Uh-huh. Again, the interviewer is saying to her, what was it like to be in this gritty, medieval, realistic movie, unlike Camelot, which is all about the pastels, but this was gritty realism.
Did she have an answer for this?
She sidestepped into talking about what it was like to be the only woman on set.
Okay, that's much better. Yeah, that's good. That's good. That's good. Yeah, because that's part of medieval realism too. There were really no women in the Middle Ages at all, really, except, you know, if you happened to be with them on their wedding night. Other than that, or if they committed adultery and you got to take their money. Other than that, no women in the Middle Ages. It was all about war. Mm-hmm. Da 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 da. Well, April Fools. Yeah. We haven't discussed Braveheart yet. I think we need to mention Braveheart, which is our, I don't know, Braveheart is kind of our, the most hated, we have lots of hated things on True Crime Medieval, many of them actually medieval, but Braveheart is one of our current dislikes.
That is definitely guilty of reviving some, because I mean, even now, if you go and you search up historical fiction, Droit de Seigneur, you're going to get all these purported historical romances that use it as a jumping off point. Which, you know, I don't know. That's just not doing it for me. An arranged marriage that becomes a love match, that works for me because that's less abusive, but this as the basis of historical romance does not work for me from the get-go.
No, either for, oh, it turns out I love you, kind of like the Luke and Laura, you know, soap opera thing, or the, oh, thank you for rescuing me, my, you know, either way, it's just like, can we just not do this? No. Braveheart.
Yeah, he just plops it in there like, you know, it's a thing that everybody knows.
Well, yeah, it's one of the reasons that you have to have freedom. You have to have freedom because of the badnesses. And that's one of the badnesses. How bad could these people be? This is how bad. And it's essentially driving the laws and the, you know, against Catalan serfdom, too. It's one of those. How bad could it be? This is how bad.
Yeah, Barreau makes the point that when this is talked about, it's always talked about as, you know, the people over there in the past, the ones that we don't really think are all the way human anyway. So it's attributed to the Scots, it's attributed to the Irish, it's attributed to the Native Americans after colonization of North America mm-hmm. begins.
It's attributed to the Afghans. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jesus.
Yeah, Burroughs' book is very good. I was troubled at first that he was going to get all French on me and start talking about theory, because the introduction does sort of take a little waltz into theory, but then he goes back to history, and so I'm happy.
A little theory goes a long way, huh?
Yeah. I had a terrible adventure getting a hold of this book because I thought I already owned it.
Oh.
I had seen this book at Kalamazoo, and it has a very striking cover.
Is this the one that you sent me the picture of and we think we're going to use?
Yes.
Yeah, because the cover is so striking as to sort of be sort of numbing, actually.
So I saw this book at the book fair at Kalamazoo a few years ago, and I thought I had purchased it, and I can't find it anywhere on my bookshelf. I couldn't. So I get on, and in a moment of stupid thinking I'm going to resist the evil empire, I order it from the University of Chicago Press rather than from Amazon. This was a mistake. Because the University of Chicago Press did not understand my urgency and my need to get hold of this book.
Yeah, the one thing, well, Amazon is an evil, evil thing, but it does understand that you want your thing right now, and you just could not get to the server.
I ordered the book on March 11th. If I had ordered it from Amazon, I would have had it on March 13th. On March 17th, almost a full week later, I finally get a lackadaisical email from the University of Chicago Press saying, oh, just so you know, we've shipped the book. I'm like, what do you mean you've shipped the book? Come here! I needed it 5 days ago.
This is how the evil empire maintains its imperiosity.
This book must have been carried to me by carrier pigeon because I got it on Monday, the 22nd.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Well, you've done a lot of work
diligently.
Yeah, that's right. We record on Wednesday, oh, beloved listeners. This is 2 days later. She got that book 2 days ago.
Thank you, University of Chicago Press. What kind of time frame did you think I was working on here? So here is the moral to the story. When you're at Kalamazoo in the book fair and you see a book and you think, that's interesting, do not have a moment of virtue and say to yourself, but I'm a medieval drama person. I don't need that book. Why would I ever need that book? Don't spend the $20 on that book right now. Oh, you go ahead and buy the book because you might end up a medieval generalist doing a podcast, yeah, and then you need everything.
Well, see, when, to be fair, but when you were
thwarted when it comes to resisting buying books,
you had no idea. You had no idea that you were going to end up in a podcast, which you hadn't even heard of at that time. So there you go.
So, but I'm taking that as a sign that if I think I should buy the book, I should buy the book.
Just buy the book. Just buy the book. Because, yeah, we probably need to talk about it at some point. So, yeah. So anything more on this thing which didn't exist?
No, but I'm really glad to have had a chance to go back and find out solidly why we know it didn't exist, as opposed, because you do sometimes, you know, you go along and you know something and then all these other people think they know something and it starts to get confusing.
Yeah. Yes.
Everybody knows that brides got married in June because that's right after they had their annual bath and so they smell good. I don't think that's true.
Yeah, no, that's not true. Everybody knows that people used a lot of cinnamon in order to cover up the taste and odor of the spoiled meat that they were eating. No, no, no. Everybody knows. Yes, so part of the absurdity of this also, which we should mention, is that the entire structure of this first night business depends upon a virginity that can be taken. Therefore, the virginity being there.
Right.
And you were telling me about church court records.
Well, yeah, we know, well, from Shakespeare's time, but it's not going to be much different earlier, that a third of brides were already pregnant on their wedding day, because we can do math, right? We know when the wedding happens, we know when the birth happens, we just have to do a minor bit of subtraction and discover that. So I just cannot imagine that claiming the right to sleep with a woman, you know, deep in the throes of morning sickness in that first trimester is really going to be a good time. At least that's not what I remember.
No, it wouldn't. And I don't believe that in medieval Europe, people were waiting until they got married all the time because they were so well behaved. No, because you know why? I think they were human. I'm thinking they were human, and I've met the humans, and so no. So this is an entire, this is insane. It's not just that it presumes that the Middle Ages were more barbaric than we are, whoever we are who's repeating this myth, but also that they were in some bizarre way better behaved. All right. So you can't have it both ways. You can't have it both ways.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that, but it does assume both barbarity and chastity.
Just nuts. It's just, so really, please. Please, as we beg of you here on April 1st, be very careful about telling lies about other cultures and other times. It's not polite and is stupid. And it's tacky.
It wasn't super uncommon for working class people. You know, if you had to wait to get married until you finished your apprenticeship and then your journeyman, you couldn't get married until you were almost done with, you know, the equivalent of graduate school. So you were like 26, 27 years old. What you're really doing when you get married is being able to set up your own household away from your parents. And so it's not uncommon for couples to kind of have an understanding and sometimes a couple of kids. before they actually are officially married. That would be very disappointing to the Lord to get some mother of two hauled in there.
Yeah, the kids running around screaming, looking for their little wooden horses. Yeah, that's not good. No. This is just insane. But we're so willing to believe it. Well, everybody knows that there was Stratosenior, but now we hope that you know that there wasn't. There wasn't. Do people behave like that? Yes, they do sometimes. And in fact, sometimes it becomes an entire custom. And sometimes it's just a thing that's happening all the time. But it was not a custom in the Middle Ages. It was not a law in the Middle Ages. It was not a right that lords had in the Middle Ages, although some of them would have done that, but it didn't. It's just a one there. It's a thing that got invented and then put on to the Middle Ages, because the Middle Ages are always the place where bad things happened, as opposed to now, which is entirely well-behaved.
Everybody's so good now. Yeah.
They are. Thank God we are living now, post-Middle Ages, in this happy time of good behavior. Yay. The next time that you hear from us, we will be discussing the University of Paris strike, which took place in France, obviously, in 1229. And so, yay, we get to talk about the town gown problems of the Middle Ages, which still to some extent have. Yeah, we like this.
Because undergraduates were not any better behaved.
Yeah. Oh, no, they were. They were all so well behaved. Undergraduates were well behaved, and nobody ever slept with each other before marriage. It was the Middle Ages. Okay. None of this makes sense. All right. We move on. No, the undergraduates were so badly behaved that there were deaths involved. And so really, that's what we'll talk about. Okay. University of Paris. Yeah. Later on, we'll do Oxford, but we're doing Paris now. Well, this has been True Crime Medieval, where the crimes are just like they are today, only with less technology. And the lies, I don't know, people made things up then too, I'm just saying. We are on Apple Podcasts, iHeart Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, any place that the podcasts are hanging out. We're apparently there these days. Please leave a review. We'd love that. We've had like 22 reviews on Apple. It was like,
ooh, that's exciting.
I know. It's like, you know, we have a little slow build up here, you know. We didn't like hit and like, we're not one of those podcasts that became like really famous all of a sudden. In fact, we haven't become really famous at all, but we have more listeners now than we did a year ago. C'est la vie. You can reach us at truecrimemedieval.com. True Crime Medieval's all one word. And there you can find the show notes, which are written by Michelle, the transcripts, which are done for us by Lori Dietrich, and you can also reach us all through the webpage, and you can leave comments. We'd love to hear from you. If you have medieval crimes that you think we should pay attention to, please let us know. We'll take it under advisement. And let us know also if you have things that you want to correct us on or add to what we said, because then we'll say them. After you do that, and we find them out, and yeah, so that's us. Bye. Happy April Fool's Day. Don't believe lies. That's what we have to say. Bye. Hello and welcome to True Crime Medieval, 1,000 years of... Wait. Yes, that is our name, isn't it? I'm sorry. It's ADHD girl here. What day is it? Do I need to put the towels in the dryer? Reese? Reese dog? I heard that he's deaf, and so when he manages to know that there's somebody at the door, he gets really excited. It's a package. It's okay. Reese? It's okay. Good dog. Okay, good dog. Still barking. I go lay down now.
You never know when the postman might be there to do something dreadful.
That right. They come to steal.
You know that even Even now, the vast majority of the websites I was finding about this were hedging their bets. They were saying things
oh,
like,
really?
It didn't really exist in most places or most times as far as we can tell.
God almighty.
Yeah, that was, and Snopes. Snopes was one of them. Snopes has a page Snopes, about
I
it.
I saw that. Snopes has a whole damn page about it and never actually comes down. It's so, you know, it's just really hard to let go. And I think that one of the reasons it's hard to let go is that do people behave like this? Yes, they do. Male entitlement over women's bodies? Yes, they do. But it wasn't codified. And it wasn't this was not the custom.
I forgot to mention that awesome thing that shows up in some of the travel narratives, because this also, you know, is connected to that whole thing about travel narratives. This is how people over there behave. This is how people over there behave.
The ones with the feet on their head.
Well, that's in one of them, but in specifically a sex-related one is the story about how in that country over there, in that island, men pay another man to deflower their wife on the first night because some women have little snakes in their vaginas that will bite you. And you can't really tell ahead of time. So if you're a smart and cautious man, you pay some other brave soul a lot of money to just check out the territory before you risk it.
That's the layers of the layers of that are almost infinite, really.
Yes,
wow.
I'm sure the analysts would have quite a lot to say about that.
Yeah, it must show up in some of your books. Yeah, okay, so that didn't happen either. Nobody was doing that, and it didn't exist. It's a thing which didn't exist, like the people with feet on their heads. Yeah.